Case number 15-7040, Marietta Robinson, appellant, versus Sarah Pizzette, officer et al. Mr. Ross Eaton for the appellant, Mr. Mortarena for the appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Tobias Ross Eaton of Sibley Austin for the appellant, Marietta Robinson. I'd like to begin with the two independent grounds for Mrs. Robinson's first Fourth Amendment claim against officer Sarah Pizzette for shooting Mrs. Robinson's pet dog, Wrinkles. Officer Pizzette should never have opened the door to Mrs. Robinson's bathroom, placing her face-to-face with Wrinkles. If she had not done that, we would not be here today. The defendants have justified Officer Pizzette's decision to open the door by reference to the general interest in securing the scene of the execution of a search warrant, preventing the destruction of evidence, and officer safety. But I don't think the defendants have contested that it would have been unreasonable for Officer Pizzette to open the bathroom door if she had known or should have known that Wrinkles was behind it. So really, that general interest is not dispositive here, and the ultimate question is, as a factual matter,
is it enough that Wrinkles was behind it, or also that other officers had cleared the room?
Well, I think there are four.
If you're an officer and you walk by a door where a dog is barking, you don't know whether also in that door are five armed men. So I assume under those circumstances, it would be reasonable to open the door, or do you think not?
I think that here it is the entire sequence of events that should have told Officer Pizzette not only that Wrinkles was behind the door, but also that the room was safe and secure.
So both. You agree it has to be both?
Yes, that's right. Beginning with the search team's interaction with Mrs. Robinson when they first arrived on the property, in a situation that the defendants themselves have emphasized was deadly serious, Officer Pizzette was, by her own admission, laughing and joking around with the other officers in the search team, imitating Wrinkles' bark. Officer Selby similarly said that the officers at the back of the search line were talking to each other in a situation when they plainly should have been paying attention to what their commanding officer was doing. This is the middle of the night. It's dark out. They've come to this property, and as they have emphasized many times, they don't know what they're going to find. That's a situation that calls for complete attention, and Officer Pizzette certainly was not paying complete attention.
I'm curious, did you start with his argument because you think it's stronger than your argument that there was a genuine issue of fact over whether the dog was lying down before it was shot?
Honestly, I think both of these arguments are equivalently strong. We emphasized the genuine issue of material fact in our briefs because that seemed to be sort of more glaring error in the district court's opinion. This one comes first chronologically. I'm happy to discuss them, of course, in whichever order the court prefers.
If we were to agree with you about the first issue, I mean the genuine issue on whether or not the dog was lying down, do we even have to address the opening door question?
No. Either of these arguments, I think, would independently suffice to call for reversal here and then remand for a trial on the Fourth Amendment claim against Officer Pizzette.
Are you sure we wouldn't have to approach the first issue, too, if we agreed with you on the second and remanded the district court? What about how would the district court handle the first?
Well, I think in that situation, that issue would probably go to the jury, and so it may be something that this court would want to offer guidance to the district court to address on remand.
In other words, both issues go to the jury, don't they?
I think that's right.
So they're really, I'm a little puzzled as why they're different.
Well, I should say I do think both issues should go to the jury because there are disputed issues of material fact on both issues, but I do think that they are independent grounds. And so even if you agree with us on one but not the other, either one independently would suffice to require remand.
But you see my point. I'm not sure we should ignore one.
Well, and I don't think that it is necessary to ignore it because I do think that, as the Supreme Court has said, the Fourth Amendment reasonableness inquiry is a totality of the circumstances inquiry, and it certainly is appropriate to consider the entirety of Officer Pizzette's conduct from the time she first arrives on the property.
Was the qualified immunity issue raised below or not?
It was not. The defendants did couch their arguments in their motion for summary judgment and reply in terms of qualified immunity, but at no point did they suggest that any of the legal issues that we're addressing here were not clearly established. They argued simply that on the merits there had been no constitutional violations.
Well, wait a minute. Did they raise qualified immunity or not? I'm a little confused.
They did raise the defense of qualified immunity in their answer, and they did argue, they couched their arguments about the lack of constitutional violations in terms of qualified immunity, but they never made any arguments that go to the second prong of qualified immunity. So it is probably right to say they did raise the defense.
The second prong being?
The clearly established law.
Well, I'll ask them. So is it your position the whole qualified immunity issue is waived if it's not before us?
I would say that the defendants have waived any argument that any of the legal standards that we're applying here were not clearly established. But even if the court does choose to reach that question...
Well, then how can you have qualified immunity if it's not clearly, if it is not clearly established? I don't understand.
Well, because qualified immunity has two prongs, the first, of course, being was there a constitutional violation in the first place, and the second, which is an entirely separate question, what was the state of the law at the time, the defendants made no arguments in the district court as to the second question, and so I would suggest that they have waived those arguments here. But even if the court is inclined to reach that question, I would submit that all of the legal standards are clearly established, and I think that is why the defendants did concede that below. Every circuit that has considered the question has concluded that shooting a pet dog when the owner is present and obviously desires to retain custody of the animal is a Fourth Amendment seizure, and that therefore a police officer cannot do so unless the pet poses an imminent danger and the use of force is unavoidable. This court has also made clear since 1982 that searches cannot be more destructive, more invasive than necessary. So I do think that all of the legal standards are clearly established.
But on this question that you'd like us to give advice to the district court on about passing the door or opening the door, that's not quite in the same league as the other two, is it?
I don't think it is, but I do think that whether that is viewed as part of the seizure of the dog or simply a more invasive aspect of the search, the cases do make clear that that is...
Cases in other circuits on specific facts, but no case in this circuit.
Yes, that is correct.
And the district court didn't rule on this question about opening the door, right?
That is also correct.
So this would be like a little advice for the district court you'd like us to give, or...
Well,
I understand why if we were going to rule against you on that ground, we need to decide that question. I don't understand why we would decide that question. Now, the district court hasn't said whether there's a genuine issue of material fact on that or not.
Certainly it would be open to this court to remand for the district court to consider that issue, but I also don't think that that's necessary because the record is fully developed here. And so I don't think there's anything stopping this court from reaching that question.
And they haven't. Do you think they've waived below their ability to argue about clearly established law?
I do think so, yes.
Well, they moved on certain grounds for summary judgment. Does that preclude them from moving on other grounds for summary judgment if they lost their first motion for summary judgment?
Not necessarily, no.
Well, then there wouldn't be a waiver.
No, it may well be open to them to argue it again on remand, but as I said, I do think that
your
issue
argument
is waived here.
It's waived here.
Yes, that's correct.
Doesn't mean they can't raise it again in the district court.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. What's the best, on the question of her seeing Wrinkles lying down and being shot while he was lying down?
Yes.
What's the best page of the joint appendix that you can give me on this?
If you turn to page 222 of the appendix, you will find Mrs. Robinson's testimony on this point, and I believe actually this discussion begins on page 221.
And what sentence you're talking about, and which sentence are you talking about?
So if you look at the very end of page 222, we have the beginning of Mrs. Robinson's description here. She says...
End of 222?
221, pardon me.
Okay.
Mrs. Robinson says, referring to Wrinkles, she stood up, excuse me, let me correct myself, when she shot the first time, Wrinkles got up. And when Wrinkles got up to come towards her, then she shot again. And so then the defendant's counsel asks, is it your testimony that Wrinkles was on the floor, lying on the floor? The answer to that question is yes.
Well, why don't you go on then? What's your response then to the district's argument that the plaintiff says yes, and then the lawyer says, well, how do you know that? And then she doesn't answer the question.
Well, admittedly, her answer to the how do you know that question is not directly responsive. But I would submit that it is not nearly sufficient to permit the conclusion that no reasonable juror could find that she actually did see what happened.
Why?
Well, cases applying Federal Rule of Evidence 602, which is the personal knowledge requirement, are quite clear that evidence should not be excluded on this ground unless no reasonable juror could find that the witness observed the events that she was testifying to. And here, I think if you read the entirety of Mrs. Robinson's testimony, it is quite clear that she was testifying as to events that she actually witnessed. The defendant's arguments as to why she could not see rely on their description of where she was in the house, but she testified fairly clearly that she was essentially still in the entryway immediately adjacent to the bathroom and thus did have a vantage point from which she could see these events.
There's no affidavit from Mrs. Robinson or anything about this?
There is not, and the reason for that is that the defendants did not make this argument in their motion for summary judgment. In fact, they did not make any arguments about a lack of personal knowledge in the district court. They did, in their reply, say that she did not admit to seeing the bite.
No, but even on the point that Wrinkles was lying on the ground, there's no affidavit about that. Even if this question hadn't been asked, where would the evidence have come in that Wrinkles was on the ground when shot?
In that situation, it may well have been appropriate to put in an affidavit there, but as it was, the defendants did not challenge the sufficiency of this testimony to establish her personal knowledge. They didn't do so squarely until they reached this court, and they really didn't do so at all until their summary judgment reply.
Does that matter since we're reviewing this de novo?
Well, I think in terms of considering the absence of, say, an affidavit that would further elaborate on Mrs. Robinson's testimony, it does matter.
Why isn't that your obligation to put in the affidavit?
Certainly, as the plaintiff, Mrs. Robinson bears the ultimate burden of proof, and right. So, of course, she does have to come forward with sufficient evidence, but I do feel that it's not appropriate to penalize her for failing to anticipate the district's argument on appeal.
Well, I don't understand that. The whole point of your case is that the dog was shot while it was lying on the ground, right?
That is certainly our central claim.
Could possibly win the claim against Pizzat if the dog were charging Pizzat, right?
Well, I think we could on the other ground.
That would put you on the door ground, which
yes.
is not your strongest ground. At least it's not your strongest ground on qualified immunity. But I'm puzzled at the litigation strategy of not putting in any evidence on the point upon which you have the burden of proof.
Well, I do think we have put in evidence on that point. I think when Mrs. Robinson's testimony is read in its entirety, it does suffice to permit a reasonable juror to find that she actually did see the events that she was describing. She testified a number of times to the sequence of events leading up to the first shot, both in the pages that we've just looked at and in the surrounding pages. She describes quite clearly Officer Pizzat entering the home with her gun drawn, turning to her left to face the bathroom door, opening the bathroom door. Mrs. Robinson at that point saw Wrinkles lying down. Officer Pizzat fired. And
was the part where she saw Wrinkles falling down? That's only with the second question by the defense counsel.
So she says that Wrinkles, quote, got up, end quote, I believe three or four times in this exchange. And
right.
I think it's quite clear, including this answer to this question we've been discussing, that when she says got up, she means that Wrinkles was lying down. She also testified that Wrinkles did not start to come out of the bathroom toward Officer Pizzat until after the first shot. And Officer Pizzat herself testified that she was not bitten in the bathroom. She was bitten when Wrinkles was coming out. So even if the court were to conclude that Mrs. Robinson could not see whether Wrinkles was lying down, I think we still have a genuine issue of material fact on this question because Mrs. Robinson did see enough of the sequence of events to see that the first shot came before Wrinkles came out of the bathroom towards Officer Pizzat.
Likewise, point me to the best language with respect to McLeod. Is that on 221 also? This is the point that Wrinkles was...
Had collapsed?
Had collapsed, yeah, at her feet. Is that at 221?
I believe that it is, yes. And there's a similar description on 222 as well. The bottom of the page going up to the top. She fell right at my feet. I had gotten myself back towards the side of the hallway. And then they started shooting from the step, and then Wrinkles ran towards the step and tried to go up the step.
One last question. I'm sorry. I don't want to take up everybody else's time. Who are the defendants in the property aspect of the claim?
The defendants on that claim are the individual officers.
Which individual officers?
The officers who participated in
which
the search.
Name
so Sergeant Butler and
I take it Pizzazz no longer, testimony is she wasn't there. Right?
That is correct.
Okay, so she hasn't been officially dismissed on that ground?
I don't believe she is a defendant on that claim.
Weren't they all originally defendants?
I'm sorry, let me correct myself. She is a defendant on that claim insofar as by shooting Wrinkles, she caused damage to the property, but we do not allege that she separately caused any additional damage because she did leave the premises.
The others who did? Butler and?
Butler, I believe, Ledesma, Hopkins, I think as well.
I thought Ledesma had been dismissed, is that wrong? Or not on that claim, but just on some of the other claims? There's a statement in the brief that says that some of them were dismissed early on.
I'm sorry, yes, you're correct. It was Butler, Hopkins, I think Baker was the other officer who
participated. On page 16, it says, of your brief, it says, after discovery, the claims against Ledesma, Johnston, Selby, and Hopkins were voluntarily dismissed. Does that mean on all the counts?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so that leaves Pizzazz, McLeod, Glynn?
Yes, that's correct.
And Butler, is that right?
That's right.
And did she see any of them do anything?
She did have, admittedly, some difficulty identifying which officers were doing what because they had shepherded her out of the house.
Right, but for whatever reason, did she see any of those officers do anything?
I don't believe that she was able to testify as to any of the individual officers' identities causing any particular aspect of the damage.
The burden of proof is certainly on the plaintiff to show that, in this case, we're not talking about institutional guilt, we're talking about individual guilt, right?
Certainly, yes.
So the burden is to show that one of those officers, or all of them, did something unreasonable, right?
I do think that at the very least she has carried that burden against Sergeant Butler because
the argument against Butler. That's a supervision argument.
Yes, because he testified that he both supervised and participated.
And what about the others?
The others, as I said, she was not able to identify them based on her own observations. But I do think that their admissions that they participated in the search are sufficient at this point.
They didn't admit that they did any particular thing. Not everything in the search was unreasonable, was it?
No, we're certainly not suggesting that absolutely.
So don't you have to show that any individual officer did, a particular officer did a particular unreasonable thing?
I think that at this point, their testimony as to their participation in the search and what exactly they did in combination with the resulting damage is sufficient to create an issue of material fact on this point.
Not really following how that could be. I mean, this is individual liability, not group liability.
Yes.
She was outside. At the most, she said she saw things flying, but she didn't see who started the flight.
Right.
I don't understand how that could be sufficient for any officer. I'll keep Butler to the side for the moment, but for any particular officer, I mean, if one officer did all the bad things, another person can't be liable for it. And if you don't know which officer did which, and you don't know, and you had an opportunity for discovery, you took the depositions, didn't ask questions like that.
Well, we did ask some questions along those lines, mm-hmm. and the defendants perhaps unsurprisingly denied having...
What questions did you ask attempting to identify which officer had done what?
I believe each of the officers who participated in the search were asked essentially whether they had damaged anything. And all of them said no, and I think there is a disputed material fact on that point because plainly there was fairly extensive property damage.
That's an interesting question.
Okay, further questions? Okay,
thank you.
May it please the court, John Martorano on behalf of the District of Columbia.
Taking that last question first.
Yes, sir.
If six officers executing a search warrant going into an apartment with an elderly woman, and there's an enormous destruction of the apartment, and she is unable to identify which of the officers did the damage. But she can testify that officers did damage. Does the burden shift at that point or not? She has no, she's not very good, she's old, she's not very good at identifying which officer did what. Does the burden shift to the officers? Or as the chief suggests, is the burden on the old woman to identify which officer did the damage?
I think the plaintiff, yes, Judge Silverman, I understand your question. The plaintiff bears the burden in sense of risk of non-persuasion in this case, where she cannot identify particular officers that have caused the damage.
Did she allege she saw the damage?
She alleged that she saw some things happening. She said that she saw an officer climbing on her dryer.
But she can't remember. She can't identify.
She can't identify them, no, sir.
So, but that officer, the one who climbed on the dryer, isn't there agreement as to which one climbed on the dryer?
She can't.
Not from her, from the officer. Didn't the officer testify that he, I thought, maybe I'm imagining, I thought the officer testified, stepped on the dryer in order to avoid the dog.
Yes.
So we know which officer stepped on the dryer.
We don't know which officer stepped on the dryer. We don't have a specific identity for him. But what we do know is that prior to those officers conducting the search, there was a crime scene team that went in there to document extensively.
Before the defendants went in, a crime scene search team came in?
Yes, sir.
There were a whole bunch of other officers in there before the searching officers?
Yes, Judge, Chief Judge Garland, there were...
Judge is good enough.
Okay, thank you. So there were crime scene officers that came in to secure the scene and document where the bullets were and to collect the bullets and the casings, and that was plaintiff's own submission. Plaintiff's own submission showed.
Right, I knew there were. I didn't realize the order. I didn't realize they came in first. Okay, go ahead.
So all the alleged damage occurred after that?
I
missed that, too. I didn't understand that.
Judge Tatel, I think the
I take it your point is that the damage could have been done by the crime scene search officers.
Yes, Judge Garland. The crime scene, this is Exhibit 12 in the Joint Appendix. It starts on Joint Appendix 322.
You do concede the damage was done.
Yes, we concede that damage was done, but it was
reasonable. Damage was done, but the plaintiff loses the case because she can't identify which officers caused the damage.
That's part of our position. Our first position is that the damage was reasonably necessary.
No, I understand that. But assuming that's not so, assuming that we conclude the damage wasn't necessary, then we're in your situation. Let's assume arguendo. Gross damage was done that wasn't necessary. There are 12, 13, 14 officers in there, and she can't identify which one did it. And you say the burden is still on her to identify which officers did it.
To put forth some evidence to show which officers the damage is traceable to.
And I take it's not just the damage. It has to be the unreasonable damage.
Assuming unreasonable damage.
No, but some unreasonable damage and some not unreasonable damage, and you have to know which officer did the unreasonable damage.
That's correct, Chief Judge Garland. This court can affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment to the district relating to the shooting of plaintiff's dog by Officer Pizzotti for two reasons.
I just pause back as long as we're before we get back to that. What about the supervising officer? What about that? Their argument is that even if you don't know who did individual damages, there was a supervising officer. And if you take Judge Silverman's hypothetical that there was unreasonable damage, isn't that ultimately the responsibility of the supervising officer?
If the damage was unreasonable, I'm not sure if there's respondeat liability in this particular circumstance.
That's not respondeat.
Why not?
Superior. That's a different theory entirely.
Okay. I would say that he would probably be.
Anyway, he's in a different category, obviously, from the others.
He is. And just going back to the first point was that the plaintiff really didn't, and Judge Tatel, you picked up on this with your discussion with Mr. Loss Eaton. The plaintiff really didn't see what was going on in the bathroom sufficient to show that the dog was shot without provocation. Of course, the court knows this case turns on
whether the dog was...
Wait, can we go back?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you just stated a conclusion. The question is there sufficient evidence from her that she did see it? And you do rely on very heavily on her answer to the question when she was asked, is it your testimony that Rickles was on the floor, lying on the floor? She said yes, and then when he said, how did you know, she gave this answer that you say is not responsive, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So I guess I have two questions about that. One is, what's your response to counsel's argument that even if this is non-responsive, you still have to look at the whole record? And she did say several times that the dog was lying down.
She said the dog got up.
Yeah, she said the dog got up.
Which necessarily implies the dog was other than
so,
up.
Yeah, so even if this is not directly responsive to the question, and then I have a second question about it, why isn't he right that we do look at all the evidence? And she said at least twice the dog got up.
Yes, Judge. Judge Taylor, you are look at all the evidence, but when you go through from about...
Then we have to give all inferences in her favor.
Yes,
right?
You do have to give all inferences
in her favor. And her uncorroborated testimony is enough. The district judge was wrong about that, right?
We understand the court's concern with that, with Judge Leon's finding.
There's a more specific question, which is, don't you believe that was error?
Yeah.
This is the case we all had in law school.
Right.
You know, the homeless person who's somewhat of an alcoholic is testifying against 12 bishops. You had that in law school, didn't you?
Yes, Your Honor, I did.
It has to go to the jury.
Exactly that case you had in law school. We
didn't have that in
Apparently
Chicago.
Apparently I went to a different law school.
Yeah, we didn't have that in Chicago. Well, maybe that's a Harvard hypo.
Yeah, you're right. That's a Harvard one. It goes before Chicago.
Judge, we certainly understand the court's concern.
When you
with
say
the
understand
finding.
The concern, we have a different question, really. Let's be as direct as we can. Imagine we believe that she actually saw, if she testified, I saw the officer shoot the dog while it was on the ground, and if eight officers testified she didn't shoot the dog until it charged her, this would go to the jury, wouldn't it?
It would.
Okay.
It would. But the testimony...
So the statement uncorroborated is error, isn't it? That statement alone.
Right.
That the district judge said her testimony is uncorroborated. That's irrelevant, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. So you admit error on that.
It was so... Your Honor, the evidence was so speculative on her part that no reasonable jury could return
her. No, it wasn't speculative. She testified.
Counsel?
Right. I'm sorry.
No, you're
not answering my question,
are
you?
Right.
I mean, wasn't that error? Whether or not you can prevail on a different ground, wasn't that error to say, to insist that her testimony has to be corroborated?
If she saw the events as she described them, then yes, it would be error.
Okay.
Yes, but okay, she did not see those events.
All right. So now let's go on to my question. You say her answer to the question, "How do you know?" undermines the rest of her testimony, right?
Yes, Judge.
And why? I'm not quite sure I understand why that is. I mean, if she had said, "I didn't see it," then you would have conflicting testimony by her. But when you have her saying several times the dog got up, and that's admissible deposition testimony, even though it's not corroborated, why does a statement, how do you know that, and her, she didn't say I don't, she just gave an answer that you say is non-responsive, why would that undermine that? What's the theory underlying that? I don't understand that.
Going back to what you said before about reading the record as a whole, and she had talked about what her story was, and the counsel broke it down piece by piece, probing the basis for her knowledge that the dog was lying on the floor and shot without provocation. And she was asked, and I'm specifically pointing to JA at 102, which is he asks her, how do you know that? And her answer is at best inferential, and it's based on the conduct of the officer outside the bathroom, not what the dog was doing inside the bathroom. And then later, she was bitten in the doorway. That was Officer Pizzazz.
Let's go back to the... So I have two questions about what you just said. Number one is, the counsel didn't follow that up by saying, wait, Mrs. Robinson, that's not what I asked you. I asked you not about the officers, but about what you saw in the bathroom. He didn't do that. And the second point is that you agree we have to view this evidence in the light most favorable to Mrs. Robinson, right?
I do.
Yeah. So, this response that she gives, she says, what she's telling him, I agree with you, it's somewhat questionable, but she could have been, when she was asked how she knew, she's telling why she was looking over there. She's answering sort of a similar, she said, I was looking over there because this officer, when she first opened the door, the gun in her hand, I got scared because I thought she was going to shoot me. That's why she was looking. She's saying to him, that's why I know why what happened in the bathroom because I was looking over there. Why was I looking over there? Because I thought the officer was going to shoot me. So if we have to view this in the light most favorable to her, why isn't that a perfectly, maybe not the most responsive answer, but one that at least made sense from her perspective?
Judge Tatel, it's not responsive. It's her burden to show that she had personal knowledge for this.
That she's already testified several times.
The only question is whether it's a fair inference she saw the dog.
Yeah.
It is not, and I say that it's not a fair inference based on this answer to the question where she's specifically asked by the district counsel, how do you know that that dog was lying on the floor? And she says, because of the position of Officer Pizzazz and her gun. And that is not responsive to the question. And it shows that she lacks personal knowledge, especially in light of the fact that she then later, seconds later, doesn't see the dog biting Officer Pizzazz in the doorway to that bathroom.
Let me go back to this question, which puzzles me. Suppose a plaintiff sues because 12 officers accosted him on the street, and 4 of those officers beat him terribly.
Do what?
Beat him.
Oh.
Beat him terribly. He sues all 12. He can't identify which of the 12 or the 4. Does the burden shift under those circumstances?
I don't think so, Judge.
Suppose they're wearing masks.
I don't think the burden shifts under those circumstances.
That troubles me very much.
Okay.
It's very hard. How old was this woman?
I believe she was 69.
Mm-hmm. A little hard for anybody, but perhaps an old woman, to identify which officer does what if a group are destroying property willfully. I'm not sure that the burden remains on her. I'm not sure the answer to that.
Judge, I think she had her own exhibit with the crime scene and could have got the hypothetical that you gave me with the masks. There would be no other way for her to determine, no other way for that person to determine who did the beating. Here, the plaintiff's own submission, gave the crime scene diagram, and gave some people that were doing that they could certainly, on reasonable investigation, found out who those crime scene officers were and deposed them, but they did not. They just submitted the crime scene diagram.
So was there a burden to depose the officers?
Well, there was a burden to investigate further to determine which officers were
The officers all denied, so what good would that have done?
Well, if the officers had gone to the crime scene and had documented what they did...
Doesn't a seizing officer have to write on the report that in order to establish chain of custody that they see... Was anything seized, by the way? I thought I saw some marijuana bags or something.
There was a... with white powder residue.
So aren't there names of the officers who were the seizing officers somewhere?
I'm sorry, Judge?
So aren't the names of the seizing... Normally on... I can't remember what the number of the police form, PD something. You have to state the name of the seizing officer so that later chain of custody can be established, right?
That's correct, Judge.
So are the names of the officers on a form like that?
Yes. There's Officer Baker is on that form.
Do we have that form?
Well, that's the search warrant return, Judge.
Yeah. Where, what page is that?
The search warrant return... is JA-142, but the crime scene evidence report, Judge, mm-hmm. is at 323, and it talks about, you know, who the officer was that was preparing the report and who the reviewing officer, or there's a signature for reviewing officer. So they certainly could have deposed Savion Winefield to find out, you know, what was going on at the crime scene, but they did not. If I could just address...
Can I go on to the qualified immunity question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you raise that below?
Specifically we did because our defense on the merits is the same defense as on the qualified immunity analysis, and the district court just simply passed on that, then they addressed the merits.
You mean the first element of qualified immunity?
Yes, Your Honor.
But you didn't ever address the second.
Never addressed the second. The district court passed on that issue, Your Honor.
But did you argue it?
We did not.
That's what I thought.
So is it waived?
Yeah. For our purposes, only ours.
I don't believe it's waived, Judge, because I think you can affirm on any basis. That's
clear. Well, we can affirm on any basis argued below whether or not the district judge relies on it. But I don't know if we can affirm on a ground not even presented below.
Yes, Judge.
What? We can't affirm on a ground not even presented below?
No, I don't think you can.
No, we can't.
I don't think you can do that.
So it's really not in front of us at all, is it?
It really isn't.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
And just to briefly address the opening of the door, you know, that action was not unreasonable under the circumstances in this fast-moving, dangerous situation. And if I may address Officer McLeod.
Wait, before you go on,
yes.
The district court didn't address that either, right?
No, the district court did not.
Right. So if we were to agree with plaintiff on the first question, that is, that there is a material fact, we don't have to address that question, right?
No, you do not have to address that question. Right. And to just address Officer McLeod, because there is a charge on him, we recognize that Plaintiff Robinson's testimony that the dog was momentarily laying down on her feet when she was shot by Officer McLeod, that, you know, this was a very fast, dangerous, moving situation where Officer McLeod made a split-second decision to shoot a dog that had just seconds before violently bitten another officer in the group. And to hold him liable on this ground would, you know, undermine the standard and the deference that's given by
Does it even make any difference to your argument? Suppose the evidence was clear the dog was lying down next to her. What difference would that make under your theory? I mean, the dog had bitten the police officer, right?
Right.
That's enough for a reasonable officer to shoot the dog, right?
That's correct.
This question of whether the dog was lying down next to her is irrelevant under your theory, right?
It really is irrelevant under that.
Okay.
Further questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Apparently no time, right? I'll give you another 2 minutes. Could you start by answering this problem created by the intervention of the crime scene search officers before the defendants at their search?
Yes, so certainly that is a problem, although I have to say this is another issue that the defendants did not raise until their reply on summary judgment. Their motion for summary judgment as to the property damage argued solely that the extent of the damage was lesser than the damage permitted in other cases on different facts, and therefore was constitutionally reasonable. There was no question about the identity of the officers who actually caused the damage until the reply, when they essentially raised the point that we've just been discussing, that there had been this crime scene search team. So this is another respect in which Mrs. Robinson was prevented from putting in more evidence, potentially, by the fact that this was not raised in the motion for summary judgment. Ultimately, though, I do think the answer to this question is the concern articulated by Judge Silberman, which is that it's not exactly fair to put on Mrs. Robinson, notwithstanding that she is the plaintiff, the burden of identifying each individual officer who was trashing her house when they had just forced her out of her house onto the sidewalk to wait while they were doing it.
I certainly understand that argument. I don't know what the right answer is on the law. With respect to the defendants in this case, if they were the only ones, but here they're talking about a significant number of new people coming in before these people do their own search. That seems to shift things around a little bit. We don't know whether these people had any participation in that or all the bad things were done by this other team that came in.
Is there evidence that the first group didn't do any search at all?
I don't think that the record would go quite that far, although I don't think...
They picked up the bullets, right, at least?
Yes, the crime scene report does establish that the crime scene technician who wrote the report did retrieve, I believe it was at least 8 shell casings, uh-huh. Some fragments from the rounds as well. Beyond that, I don't think the record says anything about what they did, whereas we do have the testimony of the individual defendant officers as to their efforts searching the house. And I do think that would create a genuine issue of material fact. And if I may briefly just pick up on Judge Tatel's question about why Mrs. Robinson's answer to the how did you know question is sufficient. Essentially, what the defendants are trying to do here is cross-examine Mrs. Robinson. This question about how did you know, what did you see exactly, the quality of her observations, this is the stuff of cross-examination. And that is why it is not appropriate at summary judgment to draw the inference against Mrs. Robinson, notwithstanding her consistent testimony that she didn't see what happened.
Suppose there had been, in this case, no deposition of Mrs. Robinson. Would you prevail?
If she did not put in any testimony whatsoever?
Right.
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't either. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, we'll take that under submission. Thank you. We'll take a brief break while the chairs are changed.
Yeah, please.